This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about Hurricane Rita and watching and waiting and talking about results that are already coming in. The eye of Rita is expected to make landfall by early tomorrow morning. We already have reports that the water is leaking back into New Orleans. The Army Corps of Engineers has said it's overtopping, as they call it, from a patchwork of repaired levees in New Orleans. And the Army Corps of Engineers refused to call it a breach in a news conference they had about an hour ago, saying they think a breach implies that the whole wall has come down, when they're claiming that it has overtopped from flooding. Here to talk about it is Ivor van Heerden. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes and deputy director of Louisiana State University Hurricane Center. He's also an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at LSU. Good to have you back, Dr. van Heerden.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Robert Bee, professor of civil engineering at the University of California at Berkeley. He joins us from the campus there. Thank you for talking with us today, Dr. Bee.
My pleasure.
Professor van Heerden, is it surprising to see that the levees are not holding?
No, we felt that even a tropical storm could breach the levees. I guess the good news is that it's only on the Industrial Canal and the Mississippi River Gulf outlet back levees that are leaking, rather than the 17th Street and the London Avenue Canal.
Mm-hmm. Robert B., surprising to you?
Well, it's not too surprising, since I used to live behind that Industrial Canal levee.
The Army Corps is going out of its way of saying that these are overtopping, that the water's flowing over the top instead of breaching. They seem to feel that's more than they're willing to admit at this point. Would you agree with that, Robert?
Well, I think I would. From what I've seen, it looks like the water is coming over the temporary, we'll call it fill, that they made, if you will, the sandbags and those things. And, in fact, they were leaking before the storm started in their direction. So I think we're seeing just a continuum of the aftermath of the repair.
Do you think if the rain continues and if the hurricane does stall out and the rain continues, could we see more and different parts of the levees being overtopped?
Well, it'll probably, we'll call it, let go at the weakest link, and that, as you would expect, is associated with the areas that have been repaired after the so-called breaching. And, of course, some of them are just marginally stable under normal conditions. So the answer, I would say, is yes, if the rain continues to build up, and I guess we've got some high tides headed in that direction, then it says that we can expect to see more flooding.
Ivor, agree?
Yeah, the storm surge is actually peaking right now, but with the winds the way they are, the water levels in the Industrial Canal and Lake Pontchartrain are going to be held up. The one thing I wanted to point out is that Industrial Canal was sealed with limestone chips, and from the video we've seen, it has undergone some lowering in the 50 to 70 foot cut.
Why would that be? Why would there be lowering?
Well, I think it's eroding. These were flat limestone chips, and there's quite a significant flow, quite high velocities, and I think we've seen the slow but sure degrading of that sill due to the erosion.
Sort of dissolving the limestone?
No, just picking the chips up and blowing them out into the back area.
Yeah. Let me ask you, gentlemen, to wait for a minute, because we have on the line NPR correspondent Wade Goodwin, who is with us from Houston. Welcome, Wade.
Hello.
Hi. Does it seem like people are just waiting and hoping?
Yes. I think the situation depends on where you are. In Galveston, which was predicted to take the brunt of the storm, most people have left, but there are several thousand who remain behind, maybe as many as 5,000. There's been a mandatory evacuation, but there have been no efforts to use physical force to make people leave. The police are trying to coax homeless people to take some kind of shelter. There are no shelters on the island, however. And amazingly, last night and this morning, some residents were allowed to return to their homes in Galveston because they were running out of gas where they were. They were stuck in traffic, and they didn't want to be stranded out in the open on a Texas highway. And with that explanation, authorities are letting them back in to take refuge in their homes. I think it's an indication that the officials may believe that Rita's not going to hit Galveston dead on, but it's going to be close.
Galveston, though, is probably one of the lowest-lying places you could go to at this point.
Galveston is very vulnerable. In 1900, 12,000, between 6,000 and 12,000 people were killed. Thousands were swept out to sea when the Gulf of Mexico met Galveston Bay and Galveston Island just disappeared under the water. So they've raised, the island since right. then. The seawall is now 17 feet above sea levels. So there is a real measure of protection.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that, I know from my own personal experience, my nephew goes to school at Rice, and he was told to just go into his dormitory and wait it out. I imagine there are other people in Houston who have been told the same thing. You can't get out. Just, we're high enough above ground. Just wait it out and hope for the best.
Houston is not a ghost town like Galveston is. Yeah. There are still lots of people here. We're further inland, about 30 to 40 miles from the Gulf. So that's going to afford us a measure of protection. And it looks like the storm's going to pass to the east of us, not hit us dead on. And so we're expecting tropical storm winds, maybe hurricane force one winds here. And that's making people feel a little better.
All right, Wade, we'll let you go back to getting ready for your reports this evening and all things considered. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Wade Goodwin, NPR correspondent, spoke to us from Houston. Well, let's get back to talking to Ivor Van Heerden and Robert B., both civil engineers who are experts on watching hurricanes and talking about the kinds of structures. Ivor, is Galveston the kind of city that you'd like to emulate, just build it up so that the next time the hurricane comes through, you're not as low-lying?
Well, that would be one solution, but a very impractical one, because we wouldn't be able to get the necessary amount of sediment. But really, the approach to New Orleans is to intelligently use levees and seawalls and floodgates. And then, of course, tied to that is to restore the coast and in that way try to deal with the potential of surges with these rather large storms.
Mm-hmm. You agree, Robert?
Yeah, I think Ivor's in the right direction for sure. In addition, some serious rethinking needs to be done relative to the primary canals that are acting as conduits for that water into the city. That was one of the reasons that we filled in the canal that's now known as Canal Street. The other one that is, we'll call it an extremely vulnerable part of the flood protection system are the pump stations.
Yeah.
And here we've got ancient diesel engines driving the system, and many of them are in areas that are exposed to flooding, and it looks like what I'd call a substantial rethink of the flood protection, starting with those barrier islands at the coast. That's the reason nature put them there. Those wetlands perform a vital function. The conduits of water coming into Lake Pontchartrain, those need to be looked at and understood how we can better defend it. So we work the problem as a system problem rather than piecemeal as we have been.
Mm-hmm. But Katrina is still headed toward the rich. I'm sorry, Rita. How many times are we all going to say that today? Rita is still headed toward the rich oil fields and oil production refinery area of Texas.
Yep.
And they would seem to be very vulnerable now.
Well, again, a little bit of insight into the offshore industry. They've seen Category 4 hurricanes before, and of course with our friend Katrina, they saw them. The unusual thing about Katrina was when she looped into the Delta area, she went over one of the areas that we had first installed structures. There is probably about, a half a dozen, maybe as many as 12 structures that I've personally helped engineer and construct that have been put in there. unfortunately, of course, most of those structures, like me, are pretty old, and when they receive the battering earlier from Ivan, and there were storms ahead of that, well, it looks like about 47 of them around the delta have, as I call it, disappeared. Now, the structures over toward Texas, by and large, they are newer generation structures, and I hope to see the performance to be better. One of the things that we learned, again, I'll call it in Katrina, and I'll bet you that Rita does it, it's not so much the structures themselves that are proving to be the problem. It's all of the equipment and those kinds of things that are on those structures. And if they fail, then they, for example, drop through the decks, and then they hit the pipelines that are being junctured on some of those structures. And that's the reason why our pipelines are shut in at this time.
We've also seen platforms just skipping right up to the coast there.
Well, those structures have done that, I'll call it, since I've been working with the industry, and that dates back to 1960. And we've seen structures move as much as 150 miles, dragging their legs behind them. Those are mobile drilling units. They're designed intentionally for criteria that is not as severe as the heavy-duty drilling and production structures. So we're essentially seeing what we expect to see.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the refineries themselves, are they in danger?
Well, here again, the refineries have fought ahead. After my tour with Shell Oil Company, Shell Development, and Royal Dutch Shell, we worked for many of the chemical refineries along the Gulf Coast. In fact, we used to offer a storm net service, which is the sort of thing that NOAA is doing today. In fact, worked with some of the LSU people in that point in time. Joe Sahita is a very good personal friend. At that time, we would help the Gulf Coast chemical refining companies understand how to put in flood protection, flood defense systems that would make sense.
All right, I'm gonna have to have you hold that thought, because we have to take a break. We'll come back and talk about these flood protection systems and see if Fiber Van Heerden has his own views on this. So stay with us. We'll take a short break. Come right back with special coverage of Hurricane Rita from NPR News. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News, talking about Hurricane Rita this hour. I'm Ira Flatow with my guest, Ivor Van Heerden, Director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes, Deputy Director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center, Robert B., Professor of Civil Engineering at the University of California of Berkeley. Dr. B., are you saying that these, because of your work with the oil industry, that these refineries are now fail-safe for hurricanes?
No, I wouldn't say that at all, but rather it's not my work, but actually a collective work of the, I'll call it the Gulf Coast engineering, consulting, academic community. And as for most things, the community, I'll call it, the engineering community, said, well, we know you're having trouble. In fact, we've published papers in the journals saying, well, we're having trouble with the flood protection in the refineries. Here are things that could and should be done to provide levels of, we'll call it, protection to protect that vital part of our infrastructure. Now, at that point, the thing begins to show up that there are some of the operators that will take very positive action on those kinds of recommendations, and they did. And from everything we were able to tell, both for our friend Ivan and then later for Katrina, those refineries did just fine. Now, there were two other categories of owner-operators that then said, well, you know, we'll do a little bit of upgrading, similar, pardon me, to what we did to the levee system after Hurricane Betsy in New Orleans. And so they did a little bit of upgrading, and they were kind of in the moderate region. The other, what I call a hope for the best, if you will, denial, they kept the system where it was. And just as you would expect today, those are the ones that are in dramatic trouble.
When you say trouble, does that mean they're going to collapse? And does it also mean that the oil is going to leak out?
Well, no, I don't. And what I mean is a shutdown in production.
Mm-hmm.
These systems are designed in terms of their strength so that, yes, we may have some minor troubles with what I'll call it, the gingerbread and the appurtenances within those complex things known as refineries. By and large, that's good. It's this flooding that is the dramatic difference, just as it was for New Orleans versus past Christiane or down into Lafayette.
Dr. Van Heerden, there are those who talk, getting back to the levees in New Orleans, there are those who are, and reports have been coming out in various media over the last week or so, that said that the levees were basically hyped too much for their ability to withstand a hurricane, that they really were not built originally to the specs that could do that. Would you agree with that?
Well, you know, the impression in the field is that that's the case. Early reports were that those levees were overtopped, but, you know, we've been able to show through getting storm surge measurements in a number of different areas that they weren't overtopped. So really the Katrina flood in the 17th Street and the London Avenue canals didn't exceed the Corps of Engineers project flood, the design flood. And what we saw from field inspection is there appears to have been catastrophic structural failure of these levees. I think there's going to be various investigations as to why. But one of the things we noticed was that they didn't have very substantial foundations.
You mean with the actual bottom of the seawall, the canal wall itself?
Yes, the walls consisted of individual segments. They weren't linked, so they basically the system was as weak as the weakest one of those segments. But more importantly, the foundation was a 3/8-inch sheet piling, and then the concrete walls were put on top of that with about an 18-inch portion of the sheet piling actually penetrating the wall. So, you know, some have said they were top heavy. Some have said we should have used an inverted T design with a more solid concrete foundation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Beebe, before I let you go, I know you have to go. I want to ask you one question about living in this area. We've been talking in the last hour or more or so about the possibility that we are going to be seeing more and more hurricanes, well, maybe not more hurricanes, but stronger hurricanes coming into the Gulf and creating havoc because we're in a peak hurricane season and there might be a little bit of the added effect of global warming. How is an engineer, someone who designs cities and things, how can you tell people to be able to say to them, move back to an area where we know might flood again, just like we're seeing today?
Well, I guess the way that I would answer that is just through my own behavior. After we were flooded out during and after Hurricane Betsy, indeed we were flooded out. The house was a total loss. We lost all of our belongings, but yet we survived, and the reason was our livelihood was there. So we knew that we had a base to return to. We rebuilt, and that worked. Now, one of my very good friends that headed my drafting section during that time period, and by the way, I was chief offshore civil engineer for Shell at that time, ultimately he committed suicide in a response, another means of escape, if you will. So different people, depending on how they can cope with this sort of dramatic blow to their personal life, will similarly deal with it. Some will be those that stay and, if you will, fight it. There will be others that, for different reasons, can't fight that, and I call those the flights, and they'll never come back. So I think we'll see a variety.
But we require homes in earthquake areas, new buildings in earthquake areas, to be built to standards to withstand a certain earthquake before you can build them.
Well,
why would it not be frugal and prudent, is the word I guess I'm looking for, to require that a city be built to where it could withstand a hurricane if you're living in that part of the world?
Well, it would be if you weren't faced with 300 years of culture and history, for example, in New Orleans.
Similarly, as I live out here in the earthquake-prone area, we'll call it number three on the FEMA list for catastrophes in the United States, mm-hmm. called San Francisco. You can't go in and just wholeheartedly, we'll call it, raise the city and start over. You have to deal with the existing infrastructure, hopefully in an intelligent way, upgrading those things that are the highest risk first, and then progressively move through the problem until you have a system that is workable. Perfection is not possible.
Dr. Van Heerden?
Well, I, you know, go back to what I said earlier, and I agree with Robert. We have to approach this as a system, and part of the system is restoring the ecosystem, the coastal wetlands, which really offer an enormous amount of protection from the surges. We really need to perhaps look at what they've done in the Netherlands in terms of building substantial levees, these storm gates, and really rethink it. There are obviously parts of New Orleans that I believe we won't be able to resettle, that eventually be perhaps lakes or parks. But it can be done. We've just got to approach it intelligently and obviously restore the coast.
Let me ask you one question before I let both of you go. We spoke with you right after Katrina hit about some of the possible public health impacts of the storm. Did you see much in the way of infectious diseases in the wake of Katrina?
Well, I think there was not a whole lot, but although the data is still very scarce, and we got a team right now trying to assemble all the data, it seems like there has been a small increase in those with West Nile fever. And then a very large number of folk who ended up with staph infections and gastrointestinal problems. Mm-hmm.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking time from a busy day to speak with us.
We thank you and NPR very much.
Thank you. Robert Bee is the professor of civil engineering at the University of California at Berkeley. Ivar Van Heerden is the director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes and deputy director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center. We're going to now switch gears and bring in someone else. We know we talked about Hurricane Rita expecting to take a landfall somewhere near the Texas-Louisiana border on the Gulf of Mexico. And joining us now to talk more about that area and what Rita might do there is my guest, Donald Bosch, is president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences. He's also a professor of marine science at the university. He is a New Orleans native, and his previous life, if I might say, he was a professor of marine sciences at Louisiana State University and an executive director of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. He joins us by phone. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Bosch.
It's very good to be here, Ira.
What should we expect the marine environment to be once Hurricane Rita goes through there?
Well, I think the way the storm looks like it's headed now, it's going to take a path which is actually very reminiscent of another previous hurricane, Hurricane Audrey, which crossed the coast at Sabine Pass, which is right at the border between Louisiana and Texas. That hurricane was in 1957. It was a Category 4 when it struck the shore, and it resulted, unfortunately, in the death of well over 500 people. Those days, we didn't have quite the communication system, and not everyone evacuated in a small settlement of Cameron, Louisiana, and that's where most of the folks died. But one of the parts about that part of the coast, as opposed to the part of the Louisiana coast, which is closer to New Orleans, it's an area that's called the Chenier Plain, and it is an area of very low-lying, extensive wetlands, in which there are these old beach ridges that run in the wetlands with oak trees on it, thus the from the French chen for oak. And the main impact of Audrey on the environment was a tremendous storm surge, of course, which went up the Sabine Lake, a large estuary between Louisiana and Texas, as well as Lake Calcasieu, and brought large amounts of salt water up into these freshwater wetlands. Now we have, unfortunately, we do a lot of things to the environment that end up causing problems, and one of the problems that was caused then, and it's going to be an issue now, I think, is that we have lots of impoundments of these wetlands that we've done for various wetland management purposes for waterfowl. So if the salt water gets up and penetrates well inland, Mm-hmm. It'll be trapped by these impoundments, and so you'll have sitting salt water on marshes that are really fresh water, and resulted in the loss of mortality of the burning of the marshes by all the salt water there, and that opened up large areas of wetland to open water. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of long-term consequences that could result from this of a massive storm surge affected that part of the coast where it looks like it's headed now.
Yeah, we saw a huge storm surge on the Louisiana Mississippi coast. Two stories in some places. Tall. Should we expect that kind, even though it's been downgraded to a Category 3 now and washed very far inland like it did there?
Well, that's possible. You know, one of the things, again, if you know anything about the, just put in your mind's eye the geography of the coast, that's a sort of a straight, curving coastline. The area where Katrina hit on the Louisiana-Mississippi border region, the boot of Louisiana, the toe of Louisiana, sticks out into the Gulf, and so it allowed a large quantity of water to be built up by the wind being forced against the Mississippi and Louisiana coast, and so that really accentuated the storm surge in that particular case, and that's not quite the same in this particular situation. So I imagine there would be a storm surge. I think in the case of Audrey, it was 15 feet or so, but it probably won't be the monster that hit the Mississippi Gulf Coast. But we could be wrong.
Yeah, we're talking about Hurricane Rita this hour on special coverage from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Donald Bosch, and that seems to be, Dr. Bosch, the byword of this hurricane season is we could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what were we right about with Katrina, and who knows what we might be right about with Rita? All we know is that we underestimated everything, at least, you know.
Well, I don't know whether that's the case. Your guest in the previous section, Ivor Van Heerden, had, run storm surge models,
right,
and in these scenarios, and that were not that different from what actually occurred. And in fact, Hurricane Betsy that was also talked about. I lived through that storm as well, and when I lived in New Orleans in a flooded neighborhood. That was a good learning experience for what happened with Katrina, where you had a lot of storm surge piling up against the coast. This Mississippi River Gulf outlet, these channels that lead into the port there, kind of funnel the water up into the industrial canal area that was overtopped in Betsy, as it was very much similar to what it was overtopped in this case. The other aspect of that is that in the anticipatory planning, if you will, if you might have heard that in this hypothetical Hurricane Pam that they looked at, that played out pretty accurately to what happened, with one important exception, that they estimated that as many as 50,000 people could have died. So despite whatever shortcomings we had with respect to the evacuation procedures, the fact is a lot of people left town, and we reduced mortality as a result of some level of planning anyway.
Yeah, I think I was being a little generous with the royal we when we said we, because we have talked about all of those plans and all those, and Pam, and they forecast almost exactly about how this one would play out. And in fact, can't remember off the top of my head, we had a guest on who was telling us that after this planning session, he had suggested to the federal government that there's going to be a huge evacuation problem and that they ought to plan for an evacuation and actually create a little city for people in dry land to bring them to. And he was told by, I think he said FEMA, that Americans don't sleep in tents, I think was the exact wording
right,
that he got back. So they're sleeping now in tents.
Yes.
And not where they want to be either.
Well, I think also, you know, the problem is that if we don't experience these events in our lifetimes, we don't know how to respond to them. And over the last several years, when the risk to New Orleans have been raised in public consciousness, this isn't the first storm where there was a large-scale evacuation. And then progressively, they got better. They had the same sorts of log jams on the interstates and so on in earlier storms. And in Hurricane Katrina, they had more people had more experience with this contraflow where they open up both sides of the interstate, and people were able to leave more expeditiously than it seems to be the case for Rita.
Dr. Bosch, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Sure.
Donald Bosch is the president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences, where he's also a professor of marine science, and he joined us by phone from Cambridge, Maryland. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about Hurricane Rita and talk about ocean science and the impact on the oceans that a hurricane like Rita might have. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to special coverage, Hurricane Rita, this hour from NPR News. We are trying to keep you up to date on what's going on with the hurricane. Last week, we checked in with the folks who predict hurricanes. They told us that it's been downgraded to a level 3 hurricane. It's expected to make landfall somewhere in the Texas-Louisiana coastline and those environs sometime in the early morning hours around sunrise tomorrow morning. And we're now here trying to talk about what to expect. What might we see when Hurricane Rita makes landfall? How different might it be from Katrina? Can you predict? You know, we talk about one of the greatest devastations from a hurricane comes from a storm surge. You know, it's that storm surge that wiped out 6,000 to 12,000 people in Galveston in 1900. You've seen the destruction from the storm surge in Katrina. Scientists like to make models about storms and oceans and things. Can we make a model for a storm surge that will accurately predict where it's going to go, how far inland, kinds of things like that? Well, people are working on it, and one of them is Leonard Pietrafesa. He is professor of ocean and atmospheric science at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mr. Plato. Happy to be on it.
Call me Ira. No one except, you know, the IRS calls me Mr. Plato.
Okay, Ira.
Is it possible for you to, I know you've been working on making models, and you did one for Hurricane Dennis. Can you predict accurately the extent of storm surge now?
Actually, we've gotten very good at being able to predict the storm surge and the subsequent inundation that will occur accompanying these tropical cyclones, yes.
Can you go out on a limb and tell us where you think Rita might wind up?
Well, if Rita follows the track that she's on, she's actually going to beach herself, it looks like, to the east of Port Arthur. And what that means is that as she gets to about, 30 or 40 miles of the coast, on the right side of the eye, the wave field that the coast will experience is going to be the order, certainly, of 4 to 5 meters. And that wave field will be riding on the surge that will be, the surge will actually be greater on the right side of the eye, but it will, and that will be about the order of 20 feet or thereabouts. So if you then add the waves as they break onto the surge, it will add up to the order of about 24, 25 feet of water. And that water will come inland then. Of course, if it will extend some several miles inland.
Wow, that's, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the ABCs of storm surge, because people have been listening to it for weeks now.
Right.
Is it caused just by the wind? You know, if you blow on a cup of coffee, you see like little waves on your coffee cup. Is that basically the same thing that's happening?
Well, in some sense, yes, but there are more components to the surge itself. One is the mechanical driving of the wind as it blows the water towards the coast. Since the coast is, in effect, a coastal barrier, the water level rises at the coast, and it rises in advance of the storm, particularly on the right side of the storm. If you think about the left side, or to the left of the track of the eye of the storm, those winds are actually blowing down the coast, but off the coast. So they might actually cause a drop in water level.
It's counterclockwise rotation.
Right, it's the counterclockwise. So on the right side of the eye, the water level will rise just due to the mechanical forcing of the wind as it's blowing towards the coast. Also, the wind will blow, will create waves, and the waves will propagate not only with the event itself, but away from the event. And so those waves will break, but they reform, and so they add to the water level that's being driven toward the coast. You also have, though, underneath the eye, a rise in the water itself, because underneath the eye is where the atmospheric pressure is lowest. And so the water level will actually rise several tens of centimeters underneath the eye, which is the order of a half foot or a foot. So they have to add that in as well. And then finally, you have to account for the tide. And the tide in the Gulf of Mexico is not very, it's not a very large amplitude tide, so it's the order of a foot or two, whereas on the east coast of the United States, you're talking about the order of 3 or 4 feet. So when you add all of those pieces together, you then have the surge. And if you include the tide, then you have what's called the storm tide. If you don't include the tide in your calculation, then you have just the surge due to the storm itself. Now, as the storm is approaching land, if there is a harbor or a river or an estuary that is located along the coast, normally, of course, that river or the harbor or the estuary, particularly on a low tide, the water would be flowing out into the coastal ocean. But as the surge due to the storm moves towards the coast, it will actually block the flow of water out of either the harbor or the river or the estuary. And you can think of it as sort of filling a bathtub with a soap dish on the side. The coastal ocean has so much more water that it's bringing towards the coast than a river or a harbor or an estuary can is bringing away from the coast, that what you do is, as you raise the water level in the bathtub, you fill up the soap dish, so the soap dish can't empty. And what that does is that forces the water in the rivers or the estuaries or the harbors to back up. They go into what's called a storage mode. And then, given the shape of either of the harbor or the river or the estuary, as the water level begins to rise, not only from the water coming in from offshore, but also because there's generally water coming down the watershed due to the precipitation accompanying the event, the water level will rise up to a certain level, and then it will simply have to move laterally. And when it starts to go out laterally, it goes out rather quickly.
Yeah.
So that's what it's like an explosive inundation, lateral inundation of the land.
But how far in? You're talking about going miles inland, and we saw that happen with Katrina.
Yeah, and that is a function of the fact that if wetlands have been removed, in a beach area, for example, if you have a barrier island system, if the barrier islands have been paved over and the maritime forests have been removed, then there's very little to absorb the water, and so including both the surge that's coming in and the precipitation that's coming down. And so the surge itself may only go in the order of a quarter or half a mile, but the effects of that, the blockage of the natural drainage systems, will then be compromised, and so inundation will occur far, far upstream of the coastal zone itself.
And you'll also have those waves pounding whatever is up there.
That's right. The waves ride on top of the surge because the waves break. And, of course, waves have a lot of energy in them. And, they tear up highways. They knock down buildings. So you actually The waves are responsible to a large degree for the projectiles that that we become so familiar with.
Yeah,
so it's not just wind, it's water.
And you see those waves taking out buildings, you know, that's, I think that what's worried some people that we're now in an industrial section with the refineries and these waves pounding on them if they're close to the coast.
That's exactly right.
You know, what do we have to, you know, in terms of repairs or what do we have in damage, what kinds of... you know, how long will that system be out with the pounding of waves, and what these surge can last for many hours?
Yeah, it all depends on the speed of the event. If Rita slows down, the outcome will be further exacerbated, because a slow moving event allows for all of the water systems to respond fully. That is, there's generally a spin-up time. For example, if you blow a constant wind along the coast, it takes about 8 hours for the water to fully respond to that wind. And so if in fact Hurricane Rita slows down, then the water systems will have more time to block the exiting water. And not only that, but the waves will simply continue to come, and you know they'll ride the surge, and so the whatever property exists along the coast, it will just take a pounding for a longer period of time, and so more damage will be done.
Wow, we'll have to just watch. You'll have to watch and see how this turns out. Wow, it's pretty scary to think about. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Well, you're welcome.
Leonard Pietrafese is professor of ocean and atmospheric science at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina.